chapter 3. Chapter 3, as you can see, is kind of a hodgepodge of different issues sort of marching loosely under the same banner, but with distinctly different sorts of personalities. At times, it appears the issues in Chapter 3 really belong back in Chapter 1, because they have to do with whether liability should be imposed on defendants for particular kinds of harms. So, for example, in the wrongful birth cases, or in the cases involving emotional harm, you could ask the question, well, gee, should a defendant be forced to pay for this? And it sounds like a question about Chapter 1. The reason it belongs in Chapter 3, or the reason it's been put there at least, is because the questions that we raise here have less to do with the defendant's conduct than with the kind of injury that the plaintiff suffers. So that it's very clear that if the defendant's negligence had resulted in some different kind of injury, there would be a recovery, but because it resulted in a particular kind of harm, the defendant says, I shouldn't have to pay for that. So again, the focus here is on what did the plaintiff suffer, but we also raise lots of policy questions about, well, is that the kind of thing we really want to compensate? That having been said, the chapter is divided into three distinct sub-issues about damages. The first section deals with sort of an inventory of the different kinds of damages that can be awarded: compensatory, punitive, economic, non-economic, cost of litigation, etc., to sort of say, okay, of these different categories, are there general principles we can identify that apply to that particular kind of damage? The second section of Chapter 3 deals with what I call related parties. What happens if you act negligently, cause an injury, but there's a sort of spillover effect beyond the immediate victim to another set of claimants? What happens if you injure the husband and the wife says, by the way, I was injured too? Does she have a right to collect damages for herself, even if we, in theory, have fully compensated the husband? What about cases where the plaintiff or where the defendant causes a death? We can't obviously compensate the decedent. They're beyond our ability to provide compensatory relief, but then what? Who gets the recovery for wrongful death? How is it measured? What about bystanders who witness an accident and are traumatized by it? Do we grant a recovery for that? So again, the middle section is centered around this idea of related parties, where the injury is not to the direct recipient, but sort of filters outward. The third section is a sort of miscellaneous series of questions about how we calculate the award. What goes into raising or lowering an award? Is there such a thing as too much or too little? What things count? What kinds of arguments can we make to raise or lower the award? So again, it's kind of a hodgepodge of different issues. As the notes also indicate in the beginning here, the article from Jaffe at the bottom of page 1 and the top of page 2, damages are often sort of consigned to the kind of miscellaneous cleanup accountant phase. And more attention is paid to the big questions of liability, Paul's graph, and all that sort of thing. And this sort of relegation to lesser status is often a bad move, because the question about damages in many instances is as important as the question about liability. yes, we need to know the answer about liability to determine whether the defendant will have to pay anything, but it's also very important for us to know, okay, if the defendant is required to pay, what sort of magnitude are we talking about? Is this a $5,000 case? Is it a $50,000 case? Is it a $5 million case? If I knew the answer to what the case was worth, once liability is imposed, I have a better basis upon which to decide, is this something I ought to be looking to try to settle, and for how much, even if I can't put my finger exactly on the likelihood that liability will be imposed. So those are the sort of general considerations with which we start. Now on page 2, we begin with the types of recoverable damages, and just to sort of speed things up, I will again just walk you through this first case, McDaniel versus Linder. The plaintiff owns a boat which is damaged by the defendant's negligent use of some sort of battery charger that blows up and or causes the battery to explode and spray these harmful chemicals. And the reason I sort of do this in passing is that of the damages questions, property damage is typically the easiest to arrive at some kind of assessment, and it's often one of the smaller items in, at least in a personal injury case. If you've been in a serious automobile accident, it might cost $5,000 to repair your car. Maybe your car is totaled and it's $15,000 or $20,000 to replace the car, but it's the personal injury that's going to take up the bulk of the compensatory award. Now, once we look at property damage, these two criteria are essentially cost to repair and diminution in the fair market value. And many of you have already dealt with, you know, an automobile collision or casualty. You know, your car gets hit by a falling tree or injured in a hailstorm or something else, and you've negotiated with your auto insurance provider to get compensation. And what they do is essentially look at, is it cheaper to repair the item? Can we simply give you, repaint the hood, take the dents out of the hood, repaint it? Or is it cheaper to pay you for the diminution in fair market value? If it costs $500 to repair the hood to this car, would it be cheaper to simply say, well, it's a 1982 Honda Civic with 160,000 miles on it. The fair market value of this car before the casualty was $2,100. The fair market value after the casualty is $1,700. All that you've suffered is a $400 diminution in fair market value. It's not worth it to repair this thing. Sometimes we refer, if they decide it's not worth it to repair at all, and they so-called total the car, meaning they simply give you the fair market value and say, here's your compensation, we'll take the car. Now, in many cases, the owner of the car feels cheated because even though the fair market value of this old beater, the price it would command in open market was $1,500, hey, it was a great car. It had all the things I shopped very carefully to get a car that had just the features that I wanted. And sure, it wasn't worth much because it had these things, you know, the back seat was all ripped up, but I never have people in the back seat, and so I don't care. But it had an MP3 player in the front, and it had front-wheel drive, and it had snow tires, and I was good to go. So the value to you of these things individually may be greater than its fair market value, but the law treats property damage primarily as diminution in fair market value. Sentimental value individual value is typically not in the equation. There are cases where you take your wedding pictures to the Photoshop and they mess them up, and you've lost the only pictures you have of your wedding. And there are, you know, what's the fair market value for pictures of your wedding? Not very good, you know, not very much. And they will try to restrict it to, you know, the cost to replace the film. And you say, no, these are priceless heirlooms. Sometimes they will give damages beyond simply fair market value, but most of the time you're stuck with the fair market value of the property. Questions about property damage? Again, it's sort of a straightforward issue. Okay, now let's turn to the more difficult questions regarding personal injury. How do we compensate somebody like Mrs. O'Shea? And one of the reasons I like the O'Shea case, in addition to being an introduction to this interesting character, Richard Posner, who writes about 3 books a year, writes about just about everything, and thinks he knows everything. But he does often have some very interesting thoughts. He's no dummy, that's for sure. And in O'Shea, we get a pretty standard garden variety case, and we get a chance to sort of think about it more more carefully. Who's not done one of these cases here? I could pick on. Yes. Mamaroni, yes. Go ahead.
All right. The plaintiff, Ms. O'Shea, worked as a cook when the defendant, who is Riverway Towing Company, carried the plaintiff to the shore as she was exiting her job. While getting off the boat, the plaintiff fell and an injury preventing her from working as a cook forever.
Okay, so the defendant's negligence causes her this personal injury. And now we're trying to calculate the amount of her compensation. And again, no big Chapter 1 or Chapter 2 issues, at least, that we're confronted with here. It's solely a question of, assuming they're liable, how do we calculate the award? Now, just before we get into the particulars of it, let's kind of set the big picture here. What is our standard for awarding compensation? We want to award compensation so that describe sort of the fill in the rest of that sentence.
Award compensation based on, well, in this particular case, for if the plaintiff is unable to work or.
Okay, but now we're getting into the particulars. I want sort of, you know, the very wide angle shot here. Fisheye lens, so to speak. What are we trying to do when we calculate damages?
We're trying to allow the plaintiff to recover.
Okay. To put the plaintiff in as good a position as she would have been in had she not suffered the injury. So, in effect, you sort of, you know, here's the plaintiff moving along. Here's the injury that takes her down. We're going to try to provide enough compensation so that she's back up to the level where she would have been. Now, obviously, lots of injuries that people suffer are, you know, injuries of irreplaceable quality. But to the extent we can, we're trying to figure out how much money it's going to take to put the plaintiff in as good a position as they would have been. Okay, so with that in mind, we're now looking at her economic loss. And in determining her economic loss, what are the factors that we use to make this calculation?
There's a lot of economics
But again, sort of generally speaking.
Oh, general, we're still general. Okay, well, basically, the way they will compensate someone's losses is to look at how much they could have earned if the injury had not
occurred.
And then there is also, in this case, a percentage of, well, what was the percentage of the plaintiff or if any plaintiff who would be able or unable to receive work for an extended period.
Okay, I sort of lost you there at the end. The first part that we have as a point of comparison is how much would she have earned but for the injury? If they hadn't negligently dropped her and caused her to injure herself, what would her future have looked like at that point? We compare that to...
Had she not sustained the injury?
Well, no, that's what... That's this part of it. What's the other thing that we're comparing? How much she will earn? Which of those two things requires us to use our imagination and speculate, and which of them we can look at sort of, you know, plain data about?
You can only speculate how long someone may have worked for. You can only speculate the, you know, inflation as far as wages, as far as getting a raise. That's always a...
That's a very speculative number. What about the future with her injury? Is that speculative?
In this particular case or in general?
In general.
In general, depending on if the injury is treatable, the person can't work for 3 years, but after 3 years they can get back to full service.
Yeah, it's potentially speculative too. So we've got one speculative measure against another speculative measure. If you sort of put it in graph form, you know, if you're putting this in a spreadsheet and punching the little chart button on it, you could look at, you know, this would have been her earnings. She gets, what's the date of her injury here? I'm not even sure it says. Yeah, let's say she gets injured in 1978. So we look at 79, 80, 81, 82, 83, 84, 85, wherever this thing is. You know, we run this spreadsheet out saying, okay, this is how much she earned with raises and inflation and promotions and so forth. We run out... How far do we run this out? How many more years do we include here?
Well, I mean, for her it was until she was 70, but I mean, it's all contingent on what the person says they were planning on working.
Right. We have to, you know, figure, well, if they hadn't been injured, how much would they have earned? Well, again, obviously, it's to the plaintiff's advantage to say I would have worked till I was 105, because that mounts up the damages. It's to the defendant's advantage to collect all the evidence that says, you know, the week before she gets injured, she was overheard saying to one of her partners, I can't stand this job, you know, I think I'll work through the summer and then quit. But again, we have to make some judgment here. Who doesn't go home from their job periodically and say, this thing really sucks, I'm going to quit? But many of us stick it out. So again, we make our best judgment as to how far in the future this is going to go. And again, this is the line or the comparison, what would have happened but for the injury. Then we have another line, which is, what do we project, in fact, will happen? In Mrs. O'Shea's case, apparently, her testimony was, I can't earn a dime. There's nothing I can do that makes any economic sense for me to try to engage in. The only thing I know how to do is cook. Cooking requires me to be on my feet. I can't be on my feet because I'm unsteady, and I'm done. By contrast, again, it's to the defendant's advantage to say, oh, Mrs. O'Shea, you should write the best-selling book on, you know, you become the Martha Stewart of riverboat cuisine. avoid the insider trading, you'll make more money than you ever did as a cook. Well, you know, how do we identify this other line? Again, it's to the plaintiff's disadvantage. Should she be enterprising, you know, go get her high school diploma, become a web designer, you know, use her sedentary life? Who knows what people will do when they have these changed circumstances? The difficulty, of course, is that her enterprise in finding another way of earning a living is directly, in effect, subtracted from her recovery. It's to her advantage to malinger, to be helpless and get nothing. That enhances her award. It's to her advantage to say, but for this injury, I would have gone places and done things and so forth. Again, this is a very typical case, and for every case you have, there are, you know, the peculiarities of somebody's physical condition, their mental condition, what people were saying about them at work, what their, you know, struggles were, and their on their good days, and what they were like on their bad days, and we essentially become novelists about what the future would have held but for this fortuity of a plane crash or a, you know, automobile accident or something else. Okay, so we take these individual slices and say, if the, you know, what was it that she was roughly about $7,000 a year, right? Something in that neighborhood. So, you know, each year we project she's going to earn a little bit more. Again, you speculate on whether she was due for a promotion or, you know, once her kids were raised or something, she was going to start working full-time instead of part-time. You know, we do all this sort of speculative stuff. But now we want to look at some other more technical issues about how we calculate the award. Now we put on our green eye shades here and start indulging in the world, not for purposes of crunching the numbers, but just so we understand the concept. You will be dealing with these things as you either defend or pursue personal injury claims. Typically, in a case that involves a substantial amount of money, you invest in an economist. You hire somebody. People over at the biz school actually earn a nice, tidy little supplemental income testifying as economists in cases involving, you know, the calculation of damages. Okay, now Posner does his thing in which he explains the way in which awards work. Let's suppose that, just for simplicity's sake, let's suppose she was going to earn $10,000. She gets no raises. She's going to work for 10 years. And there's 10 years here. She's going to earn $10,000 a year. How much does she get for her economic damages? In a world of no inflation, no raises, how much does she get?
$10,000.
No.
$10,000
for 10 years. She does not get $100,000. But there's a principle, not just the math, but there's some principle at work here that requires us to give her something other than 10 times 10. Mr. Jones?
She'll get the amount that, should she invest it, going over, say, rate, will give her the $10,000 for each.
Even in a world with no inflation, no raises, giving her $100,000 would be too much, because taking that $100,000, it used to be more, now the interest rates are very low, but at the time Posner was writing this, back in the early 80s, interest rates were at 10, 12, 15%. You could put that money into an investment, and again, one of the questions is, how speculative, how risky an investment do you want to make versus how conservative an investment to make sure you don't lose any, but your interest rate is more restricted. The point is that if you get a sum of money today, its present value increases over time because you take $100,000, invest it, and in 10 years, remembering that all you need is $10,000 a year, you're taking $10,000 out every year to pay for, to substitute for what you lost, but you're going to get the use of that money. Now, obviously, if you're talking about a space of 3 or 4 years at a 2 or 3% interest rate, we're not talking about much money. But if you're talking about a kid with, you know, a 52-year life expectancy, so you're talking about taking money today that will be invested and will be paying out over a period of, you know, 50 years, then these numbers become very significant. And you need the economists to tell you what's the proper rate of discount. We don't really know what the investment climate's going to look like over the next 10 years. It may be more like it is today. We may go back into some inflationary cycle like they had at the time the O'Shea case was written. Mr. Glover?
Assuming there's no inflation or deflation, did you say there's no interest rate as well in this hypothetical?
Well,
because I don't see how money would be worth more if there's no interest. I mean,
If there's no inflation, you mean?
Well, I was just saying, did you say there was no interest?
No, I didn't say there was no interest. I said there was no inflation. And which is kind of the world we've been living in for the last, you know, whatever it is, 7 or 8 years. Unfortunately, those of you who take out college loans, who, you know, when inflation comes along, inflation has the effect of essentially discounting, moving, you know, compressing your debt. Alas, if you live in a world where there's no inflation, the value of your debt remains relatively constant. And you're stuck paying out the same kind of dollars that you borrowed, and then some. But even in a world of no inflation, you have the advantage of getting interest on your money. You can put it in a money market fund. You can put it in a relatively conservative portfolio of stocks. You can buy municipal bonds or some other investment that over time will accumulate interest on that investment. Rubio?
I just had a question. Well, the court is saying that, in essence, she's going to invest this money and therefore she should get a discount rate because it's going to make money over
right.
time. What if she ends up... What if that $10,000 per year is what she needs to live on?
Well, in theory, she could buy high-grade securities, treasury bills, or, you know, some some investment that's as good as it gets in terms of security. And but you can also buy an annuity so that... For example, if I need $10,000 a year for the next 10 years, you could go online and plug this in. There are people who will sell you an annuity, which means they will write you a check, you know, a monthly check, let's say, for whatever $10,000 a year is, that's $833 a month or whatever that works out to. They'll write you a check for $833 a month for the next 10 years. What will that cost you? It might cost you $80,000 to buy such a thing. I don't know what the discounted rate would be. But they're in the business of taking your money today. Just as when you buy a house, you do the reverse of that transaction. You're going to be paying them $800 a month, or you take out a student loan, more to the point. You take out a student loan, you're going to be paying them $800 a month for the next 30 years, in exchange for which they give you the $60,000 or whatever it costs for a law school education. Don't make me think about that. I'm sure you're all set. And again, historically, what has happened, I must say, is that, you know, when I went to law school and graduated with a $10,000 debt, you know, it was why, you know, I graduated in 1979. I go through the, you know, the years of the 80s, the values are all inflated, and the, you know, the $10,000 was a lot of money then. It's wasn't as much as, you know, you all are borrowing, but inflation wipes it out. And you haven't had the benefit, maybe you will have the benefit of having inflation come along and essentially discount all this stuff. It's bad for the economy, but good for debtors. Mr. Tata? Yes. Sure. Yeah, it's you get into greater. Mrs. O'Shea is a relatively fixed target here. As wage calculation goes, she's a pretty good subject for painting the numbers. If you're talking about a 15-year-old kid who's hurt in an automobile accident and suffers mild brain damage, just enough to interfere with cognitive processing. How do you figure out the impact of that auto collision on a lifetime of earnings? What would this 15-year-old have earned if he hadn't suffered that mild brain damage in the collision? Huh. You know, but I can't, you know, I would be hard-pressed to figure out what my 21-year-old's going to earn if, in fact, he ever does earn any money. much less, you know, I mean, well, later on, if you've read ahead in the chapter, at the Allegheny Airlines case, what's it, Feldman? Can't think of her first name. Mrs. Feldman, who dies in a plane crash as she's just about to enter Georgetown Law School. And we figure out how much she would have earned as a lawyer. Again, very speculative calculations. What's our alternative? We really don't have one. We have to give it to the jury to do the best they can with this evidence. Defendants feel rather frustrated with it because in the case of the kid with the brain damage, the plaintiff's lawyers will present the picture of this 15-year-old with this marvelous future ahead of him. And, you know, the choir teacher will tell what a talented kid he was, and the, you know, the neighbors will say how good he was in solving this problem and that problem, why he was going to be this, you know, well, a Nobel Prize winning, whatever, CEO of a Fortune 500 company. If you're the defendant, what do you say? Nah. So, the jury's going to engage in this speculative process, and you kind of don't have a choice. Posner, as you can tell, keeps kind of jabbing the lawyers in the case, both the plaintiff's lawyer and the defense lawyer and the trial judge. He's has no end of sort of superiority of, you know, if you were only as smart as I was, this is how you do it. And, you know, in fact, you can do all these interesting little mathematical, probabilistic, economics-oriented things. But realistically, we're simply trying to figure out, okay, what would a 15-year-old do with normal intelligence as opposed to having this mild brain damage? Ms. Woodruff.
In this case, the past earnings that she's had cannot come into play. She's never worked full-time. Is that standard in pretty much every case? Because that could make a difference if we go back to what you could the last 10 years. That is the calculation.
Well, in Mrs. O'Shea's case, again, if she said, I was just on the verge, I had, you know, I was going to open up a whole string of franchise restaurants, you know, Riverboats R Us or something, and, you know, I mean, sure, she could try to do that, and in that case, the defense would be able to say, now, wait a minute, you know, you've been talking about this for 20 years, you've never done it. You get up every morning, you go off and cook on a riverboat. That's the most likely scenario in the absence of this injury. But again, with a 15-year-old who's got his good days and his bad days, yes, for every, you know, glowing report from the choir teacher about what a smart, you know, industrious, talented kid he was, you can dig up the stories about what a brainless twit he was on other days, and you know, those sorts of things will balance out. But again, we have no idea what's going to happen after they go to college, or, you know, do whatever it is they're going to do in life. We're just making it up, and again, we really don't have any choice. Chapter 3 is interesting in part because we're so fastidious in Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 not to impose liability except where it's legally justified. We can come close, but close doesn't count in Chapter 1 and 2. Close does count in Chapter 3. Once we've decided it's time to pay, we give a pretty broad leeway to the courts to say how much that's going to be. And this is still in the world of economic law. How do we calculate, for example, the 15-year-old with mild brain damage? What's the non-economic, the emotional impact of having this condition where your brain just doesn't quite work the way it's supposed to? Still functional. You know, can still get to the bank, you know, can still balance a checkbook, but, you know, the elevator doesn't quite go to the top floor anymore. Ms. DeNamer. No. For purposes, until we get to punitive damages. When we're in Chapter 3, the focus is entirely on the plaintiff. And it doesn't matter how negligent the defendant was. We don't care how rich the defendant is. We don't care how negligent the defendant was, unless we spill over into this area of punitive damages where we've gone beyond compensation to the point where we want to punish the defendant. But as long as we're simply compensating the plaintiff, we set aside all of the information about the defendant and whether they were a little bit negligent or really grossly negligent. It's all a question of what does it take to bring the plaintiff from down here where we've knocked the plaintiff to bring them back up to parity with where they would have been but for this accident. No. I mean, it may be that the defendant doesn't have what it takes to fully compensate the plaintiff. I get into a, you know, I run a red light, I hit this car. In the car is this 15-year-old who suffers mild brain damage. His income earning capacity is restricted for life. It's a question whether he'll actually be able to hold down a job. In addition, we've got this unexplored territory of emotionally the fact that he's probably not a good candidate for marriage, probably incapable because of his brain damage of ever getting married. You know, what is the amount of compensation we ought to give someone to make up for the fact that they now have this condition? It could be a huge amount of money. My insurance policy is only $50,000, let's say. $100,000 is way insignificant. I can't pay that kind of money. This kid's talking about, you know, millions of dollars to compensate. plaintiff gets my insurance policy, and that's it. Now, if I'm driving a Safeway truck, and now the resources of the Safeway Corporation are on the table, now we can fully compensate the plaintiff. Even then, it's a big chunk of money, but the resources are there to pay for it. Mr. Gallagher.
What is the impact typically for someone returning to work? So if this is going to shape and find employment in office, or what happens then to her?
Good question, and this is a very important rule, and I sort of take it for granted that you all know this, but you don't. The rule is that we do the best job we can to assess the plaintiff's damages at the time the award is made. And in fact, part of the standard pattern for a plaintiff's lawyer to say in closing argument, now ladies and gentlemen, the jury, as the evidence shows, my client's going to be living with this condition for the next 56 years. But today is the only day where he'll get compensation. Whatever you give him today will have to last him for those 56 years. I know we're talking about a lot of money here, ladies and gentlemen, but remember, this is going to go on not just this year, next year, the year after that. It's going to go to the... Anyway, I make this big pitch about the fact, give me a boatload of money today because it's going to have to last for a very long time. Once we make that award, we're done. I may get too little. It may turn out, not only does he have this mild brain damage, he now has this condition that's going to require this fabulously expensive medical treatment, round the clock, medical care, nurses. The amount of money the jury awarded is way inadequate. I can't go back, knock on the door and say, oh, by the way, I want my award re-upped. Doesn't happen. Similarly, if the plaintiff enjoys a miraculous comeback, Mrs. O'Shea does find, gee, my leg's much better than it used to be. I can cook again. I can open up this franchise restaurant. Similarly, the defendant can't knock on the plaintiff's door and say, oh, by the way, I want my money back. I overpaid you. Once we make the award, short of a finding of actual fraud by the plaintiff, we're done with respect to whether it's raised or lowered. So, you know, if I've got the surveillance video of this person, you know, who drags themselves into court, and then I've got the surveillance video of them water skiing and, you know, doing this other stuff, I can introduce that at trial. If they're water skiing the day after they get this huge award, I may be able to establish that they engaged in fraud. But, you know, if they're lucky enough to recover and lead a more normal life than we thought was possible, good for them. That's the theory, Mr. Stubbs.
Can you introduce that evidence in an appeal?
Not that the plaintiff is doing so much better than they were, because, again, the jury's job is to make a decision based on the evidence that they get. And, again, it's to the plaintiff's advantage, you know, to limp into court in this terrible, painful condition and have the jury give them a boatload of money. But it's not the plaintiff's job thereafter to continue to put up, you know, the appearance. It, from a plaintiff's lawyer standpoint, by the way, it's not necessarily a smart idea to encourage your plaintiff to put on a big act. Jurors aren't dumb. And to the extent that they think that somebody's trying to defraud them, and many of them may suspect it from the get-go. Again, defendants often look for jurors who are skeptical, who think that plaintiffs are trying to rip off institutions, that they're suspicious of this. You know, just as Kobe Bryant's lawyers want to identify people, like I heard on the news, who were skeptical, oh no, he couldn't have done something like this. You know, if you're sort of, as the expression goes, I wouldn't have seen it with my own eyes if I hadn't believed it. that if you're disposed to believe something, then you're going to see it with your own eyes, but if you're not disposed to believe it, you won't see it. So again, the jury's disposition as to how generous or not generous they are is a function of their kind of attitudes about life. But again, once the jury makes that award, we're done. And defendants feel, again, as we go through this chapter, the defendants are going to be very unhappy with the way in which this looks like a big lottery game. And plaintiff's lawyers, on the other hand, feel it's my one chance to kind of work my way through the system and get a decent award for somebody that's going to have to live with it the rest of their life. Yeah, Ms. Keene?
If the defendant doesn't have a big pile of cash or any cash at all, the jury's like...
They shouldn't know that. The judges are very careful to keep from the jury information about the defendant's wealth. In fact, the defendant's insurance policy or, you know, their insurance coverage is not supposed to be available to the jury.
But they can, let's say the jury awards $50,000 and the judge
can attach it to the income? Well, typically in an average tort case, let's suppose on my salary with my insurance coverage, I get into an accident, I cause brain damage to somebody, it's a $1 million case. I don't have that kind of insurance coverage. I don't have that kind of, you know, I don't have those sort of liquid assets. You could clean me out pretty quickly. What I would do, what other people similarly situated would do, is I'd go through bankruptcy. I'd declare bankruptcy, list this judgment as a debt, just as though I borrowed a bunch of money on my credit cards and couldn't pay it and went through bankruptcy. It's a debt. It's discharged through bankruptcy, and I start on a clean slate again.
There's no way they
can't make me, they can't turn me into their slave for the rest of their life. If I make a mistake in business, run up a whole bunch of debts that I can't pay, I get to go through bankruptcy. I only get to do it once every 7 years, but the whole idea of bankruptcy is you get a fresh start. I could go back to teaching law, taking my income. They'd clean me out of it, of all the, you know, going through bankruptcy, they'd get to, you know, short of the exempt property in a bankruptcy proceeding. So, again, the whole business about how you collect debts and what do you do with people and so forth is another, you know, creditor's rights, all that sort of stuff. But, again, from the plaintiff's standpoint, it depends very much on, this is why, again, if my client was savagely beaten in the parking lot of a Holiday Inn by somebody who wanted their purse, and they actually caught this guy, will I, as a plaintiff's lawyer, sue the guy who savagely beat my client? The liability theories are unending. The potential liability for this person, but it's that's not where the money is. The money is in the Holiday Inn. I'm going to sue the Holiday Inn and say they were negligent in not providing, you know, trimming the bushes back where my client had to go get, you know, the suitcases out of her trunk, and while she was there, she got grabbed and savagely beaten and left for dead. And I'm going to sue Holiday Inn because they got the money. And Holiday Inn would say, we didn't beat her. Well, you know, why are we paying all of her, you want us to pay all of her damages, but we're not the proximate cause of this injury. That guy rotting in jail is, well, he doesn't have the money. Holiday Inn does. So part of the dynamic of the tort system is large institutions getting blamed for bad things that either happen to people or, in many cases, that are done by criminals. I think I mentioned before my friend Bob Crotty, who tried this case against the state of Washington. You and me as taxpayers at the other end of that. because his clients, these two girls, were placed in foster care with a guy who had a conviction for attempted rape or was charged with attempted rape or something. So the state put his clients in the custody of that guy. He did all these terrible things. Who pays for it? You and I pay for it. And he would say, rightly so. But again, the part of the question that we keep asking ourselves as we go through this process is, well, when do we want defendants to pay for these injuries? When do we want to look at the plaintiff and say, gee, I'm terribly sorry your life has been a mess because the people who were entrusted with your care turned out to be a child molester, but hey, you got to do the best you can with what you got, you know, vaya con Dios. Is that an adequate answer? Is it the best we can do if we're going to compensate these two girls for what the state on our behalf failed to do? Who else is going to get compensation? Where do we draw the line? All of these difficult policy questions. Okay, let me just spend 3 minutes here dealing with the rest of O'Shea. I hope this little reverie here has been helpful. But let me point out the other aspect. The whole inflation issue, which, as I say, was a big deal in 1980, not such a big deal today. But the idea of inflation is it sort of raises and lowers both of these issues. On the one hand, if we assumed high inflation, the chart of her earnings would rise more steeply. And we'd get at the end of 10 years or 20 years with a much larger number. But what goes up in terms of inflation is going to be brought down by a higher discount rate. If you assume inflation is going to push up her nominal wages, you have to, at least according to Poser, and he's right about this, in fairness, you would have to say, so similarly, the investment climate will mean that you need less and less money today to invest to achieve the equivalent of what you would have earned. So, in theory at least, inflation will come out in the wash. What you have is awards discounted to their present value by what he thinks is a sort of net investment value of between 1% and 3%. Again, the purpose of getting you through this case is to just have some appreciation. These things matter, as we'll see later on. There's a case, Nicole Fortman versus Hemco Industries, where they come up with an economic loss of $18 million. Just the economic loss. Mostly for medical care. It's not just what this girl lost in terms of her wages, but what it's going to cost to take care of her with very significant brain damage in the Fortman case. And when we look at increases in the cost of medical care, you run the numbers making favorable assumptions and you get $18 million. So, depending on who you hire as the economist, how they build these assumptions and play with the numbers, you can come up with dramatically different projections of what would have been, and then the jury takes this all in through the expertise of the expert. If the expert says it's $18 million, the jury's not going to say, well, no, wait a second. You know, according to the federal funds discount rate and, the projected surplus, and the jury's not going to do that. They're saying, okay, $18 million. Mr. Stubbs?
Do insurance companies, when they're deciding when to settle cases, do they take this into account?
Oh, absolutely.
If the rates are going to go down, oh, we want to settle in December.
Well, they can't do that quite, but I'll start tomorrow. There's an important connection between insurance companies and insurance rates, insurance premiums. It's a little bit, I'll talk about it tomorrow.